views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
So we always say the Black Panther Party that they can do the day they want to do. We might not be back, I might be in jail, I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek and they made it with a bat. Fucking protesting them city ass. Told you go fight in the war. Vietnam, you died good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around and pump crack right up in your city. And they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called the National Guard up because we ride with our guard up. And that was brother, the Second Amendment don't apply to you. You. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. The one that you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
For those of you who don't know the pain, the government was slinging out the...
Good afternoon and welcome to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting from behind these enemy lines known as USA Inc. Today's date is August the 25th, 2015. It is a Tuesday afternoon and another hot day here in the South in North Carolina. I hope that you all are dealing with this heat properly and hydrating yourself, because it seems to be a heat wave across this entire country, even though a lot of people aren't really talking about it. I know some of the surrounding towns in my area are under water restrictions, but we have been getting a little bit of rain over the weekend, and I think it rained last night or something like that, so that's good. All right, so today we do have a guest for you. We will be joined here in just a bit by, close this out, by Crystal J. Wilson. She will be joining us from Sarasota, Florida. Excuse me, from the Tampa Bay area in Florida. She's the founding member of the Bay Area Activist Coalition. Just some quick information about the Bay Area Activist Coalition and Ms. Wilson. Our organization started shortly after the grand jury decided not to indict Darren Wilson for the killing of Michael Brown. By that January, the activists had started going to protest and rallies in the Tampa Bay area, starting a mini movement, which was covered by the local news. In February, they took on the case of Brittany Overstreet, a local teen who was brutally slammed by a officer, I guess that would be the SR, wherever this is, Sarasota, I believe, police officer. He broke and fractured both sides of her jaws. From that travesty, they started the local campaign, Kids Not Criminals. The charges were eventually dropped against Brittany. And then after that victory, they began to work on a free school. The free school taught children of African American history, taught them their history in creative ways. It also gave Black children an opportunity to become active in their local government establishment. The coalition is now working on a Know Your Rights session and planning a march from Sarasota to Tampa to bring attention to the case of Rodney Mitchell, who was murdered in Sarasota by police officers. Now, some of the things that Ms. Wilson would like to talk about is Black liberation and white supremacy. What does that look like? The violence that Black women are facing in this country, I would say even worldwide, but also self-care, taking care of oneself, and the impact of oppressive environments in children. So we'll try to touch on all of those topics if we have time But certainly we are looking forward to speaking to one of the activists down there in Florida that's in those streets putting in work. Now, in the news, I want to talk about two news articles, and I didn't list any more than these two because I have a whole lot to say about these articles. I want to analyze them, do further analyzing of these articles. Now, one of the articles, I mean, it was just so, it's so disappointing to see elder in the black community engaging in racist language towards our young people. And so this woman by the name of Barbara Reynolds, never heard of her, she is described by the Washington Post on the article that she wrote for them as a 1960s era civil rights movement activist. I have been talking about the failure of the civil rights movement, and I don't think anybody can present a logical argument to me that the civil rights movement was a huge success. But instead of these people, it seems, acknowledging the failure, and I'm not going to throw every civil rights activist from the 60s into this boat, but some of the ones I have seen that have been talking publicly on white people's press, you know, instead of them acknowledging the failure of the civil rights movement to secure lasting human rights for the future generations of non-white people, specifically black people. She's a black woman. She wants to, you know, pin on a racist attack piece for a white news corporation. Washington Post, I think from what I have observed over the years reading from that platform, is that, you know, it's a white supremacist platform, all right? Okay, so, yeah, I think it's just totally incorrect. It is just troubling to me that, you know, instead of being constructive with their criticism, I mean, no one's above criticism, but she took it farther than just criticizing them for their tactics. Now, tactics are debatable, but she went on to some personal attacks and was like, you know, using the racist stereotypes promoted by white mainstream media. And that was just very troubling to me. And, you know, if they were successful in their tactics in securing human rights for black people in this country, well, these young people wouldn't have any need to be out there in the street right now, would they? You know, that just seems logical to me. You know, if it was so successful, why are we still fighting for voting rights? Okay, if it was so successful, why are we still fighting against police brutality? If it's so successful, how in the hell did mass incarceration happen in this country? So definitely I want to talk about that. Give me just a second. I had an issue with Skype. I do believe we have our guests on the line. Do we have you on the line, Ms. Wilson?
Yes, this is me.
All right. Thank you for joining us today. If you could hang on just for a second, let me finish up the intro. Now, after that particular troubling article, well, I read that one today. It was shared by BreakingBrown.com, Yvette Carnell. She shared it on Facebook, but it's a Washington Post article. But last night, and I wrote my own article in part about op-ed piece that Dr. Ben Carson wrote attacking these young black activists that's out there in the street. And so, again, proxy racism is something, a term that I coined to describe the way black people are used as tools of white supremacy. And so, I'm, you know, it's just been a bad couple of days for proxy racism. And so it's been in full force in effect this week. And so he penned an attack piece yesterday in the same vein as this civil rights activist, Barbara Reynolds. So we'll take a look at his criticisms as well and determine if there is any validity to them. All right. So without further delay, well, let me give out the phone number. So first of all, if you have any questions or comments for our guest today or for myself, give us a call. There are two ways you can get in. Actually, three, 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-pound. And once you're dialed in, you can either just listen through the phone, as many of you do, or hit *6 and 1 to signal me that you want to comment. You can use the web-based flash phone. That's a free call from anywhere in the world, as long as you got a headset. And you can also hit us up on the studio line. That is 704-951-5030. Without further delay, we want to welcome back in to Black Talk Radio News, Crystal J. Wilson. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm honored to join you today.
Before you joined us, I had, you know, read your bio and informed the listeners about the work of the Bay Area Activist Coalition. It also lists that you have a BA from the University of South Florida. What was your discipline there?
My discipline was Africana Studies.
Okay. Is that have you found that to be helpful in some of the work that you're doing today? I know, you know, the free school project. So is that helping you, you know, with that project?
I just want to say that all majority of the members of the Bay Area Activist Coalition do have BA degrees or higher. So as far as me in particular, yes, the Africana Studies degree did help with the activism work. How to relate to African Americans. I know that sounds silly, but growing up in the Eurocentric system, learning how to accept Black people and their Blackness and learning how to communicate with Black people, the degree was very helpful in that aspect and trying to figure out the problems that we as Black people are facing and how to fix that. It did offer some solutions. It even had gave books of where the freedom movement left off and where we need to pick back up in the freedom movement. So, yes, I found the degree to be very helpful in the work that we do.
It's interesting that you say it helped you to relate to African Americans. And no, I did not think that was a silly statement, because, you know, I have been discussing with others about, you know, Black people are bombarded with the same anti-Black images as everybody else, because we have a white supremacist media in this country. So it's only logical that they could be affected by that anti-Blackness and whole anti-Black biases themselves. And I mean, I just got through talking about this civil rights activist penning this piece for the Washington Post, and she's dogging out the young Black activists out there using racial stereotypes, you know, things that we would call dog whistles if it was a white person, you know, using the sign language. And so, yeah, that was not a silly statement at all. I think a lot of us have a lot of self-hatred to overcome, some more than others. All right. So, now, you have some specific things that you wanted to talk about, but before we get into those specific things, you mentioned that the organization started shortly after the failure of the grand jury to indict Darren Wilson for killing Michael Brown in Ferguson. And so what were your thoughts on the process, the grand jury process? Did you hear anything, you know, in terms of how they did not come up with an indictment? And so what are your thoughts on that whole process? Have y'all given thought to how the grand jury and juries in general fit into the movement?
We haven't spent much time on how juries fit into the movement, but to recap the experiences that we have, I can't speak for the whole coalition itself. I can only speak about my experience. I'm still currently a student at the University of South Florida pursuing a second bachelor's degree. So I was typing my midterm paper and I was at a Lutheran church, cause a friend of mine, he runs a Lutheran church. And, I heard them talking about it. And before the verdict was announced, I had come to the conclusion, or I was led to the conclusion, that they would not indict. And that was just like, wow. At the University of South Florida at the time, I was doing an I Believe project just to hold over the movement, because sometimes people forget. They think like, oh, it happens. Okay, well, then it's over. And it's like, no, it's not over. It must be carried on into the next, I think we're calling it wave, down to the next wave, or so we pick back up on this issue of Mike Brown. So when it happened, we were sad about it, and we just really wanted to do something about it. Like, we wanted to change our society, and we wanted to make history. We wanted people to know that this was not an issue that we would let die on the forefront, because I have been aware, I'm not too sure about everyone else, I can't speak for the entire coalition. Once again, but I was aware that black males, black women, and black children were dying every single day, even though it was not reported. And it has been going on since the 1960s and beyond, because that was one of the issues that the Students of Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, was fighting for in their campaign.
I think I heard you say that you, the verdict or the non-indictment of Darren Wilson did not come as a surprise to you, that you expected it. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes. Like, I was not surprised that Darren Wilson was not indicted. However, we were sad that no justice was given to the death of Michael Brown. We do know that Michael Brown's case was diluted, just like Trayvon Martin. Like, Michael Brown became the victim. Well, he became the criminal in his own death case instead of the victim.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, those were our comments and our statements. We were just very tired. We were fed up, and we just wanted change. Mm-hmm. In the Bay Area.
Well, speaking to you specifically, you know, as you mentioned, you can only speak for yourself and not others, but what were some of the reasons? Why did you not expect an indictment to come? I mean, what was there anything, any indicators, or just based off of the history of juries in this country? So what was there any specific reasons you didn't expect justice to be rendered through the form of an indictment?
It was just previous cases, as you mm-hmm. stated, the histories of grand juries with African-American males, starting from Emmett Till all the way down to Mike Brown, touching briefly on Trayvon Martin and those that we may have missed in between, and just wasn't expecting it. At the same time, wasn't expecting for Ferguson to turn up like it did, but when it did, we were not upset about that.
The reason that I'm asking these questions about the grand jury portion of it is because, again, like you know, we both have stated, there's a long history of these juries not being impartial when it comes to black victims or, you know, black criminal defendants. There is a lot of studies and statistical data that supports that, you know, racism plays a big role in the criminal justice system and including in the jury selection process. So a little pet project of mine, I have been studying implicit bias. I've been studying autism, a lack of empathy for people. And I feel like that the United States is not guaranteeing a impartial jury to black people and non-white people in general, because if all of these white people are dominating the juries and they have implicit bias or other neurological disorders that prevent them from having empathy, that prevent them from thinking clearly, that you know, plays into their racist biases, then, you know, that's an area we need to look at improving, you know, from a legislative standpoint in implementing screening for implicit biases, racial biases. There are tests for these things that people can take, and I feel like that is an area that we're not really looking at that we should look at, because like you, what got me to looking at this is I live just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, and we just had the Randall Carrick trial of the, you know, CMPD officer that killed Jonathan Ferrell. And like you, I predicted that this trial is going to end up in a hung jury. Or either they're going to acquit them because there are just far too many white people on this jury. And sure enough, I wasn't surprised at the outcome that you had a mistrial. But I was encouraged that, unlike some of the other trials, the black people on the jury didn't go along with the crowd and let this kill a cop. you know, off on with a not guilty verdict. So, I mean, does that interest you at all? I mean, what are your thoughts on what I just shared with you?
My thoughts are, I do agree with you. I also think that a lot of Americans, and I'm saying Americans in the sense of white Americans, black Americans, and Hispanic Americans and Native Americans don't know what a grand jury is, mm-hmm. the power that a grand jury has.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're brought up in the system, because even our case, if we're just going through a case through 12 system, they don't really teach you or educate you on the powers that each legislative branch, judicial branch, and executive branch
right.
have and how they are meant to help the people. So then you have people that are frustrated with the system that say that it doesn't work. And it's not that it doesn't work. We just don't know how to make it operate. I do agree that with the, I cannot pronounce this word at this moment, the biases that individuals have, like, I think that is deeply ingrained in our society.
Mm-hmm.
Even the other day, I stood next to a white woman and she shuddered. And I was like, okay, I don't know why you're shuddering. But that is a part of the racist bias, and I think that's what Black Lives Matter as a movement for Black Lives is trying to overcome or trying to change, or that's what we're pushing for, is to get the bias or the implications out of people's head, especially white people, that, hey, not all of us are going to kill you. Hey, not all of us are going to rape you. Hey, this is not who we are. What you're seeing is a portion of Black life, and it's extended all over Black life, but we don't see that with white culture. Like, we don't categorize every white person as Dylan Root or the guy that shot up the theater or the Batman movie. Like, we don't categorize white people in that way. And why is that? And like you said, like, this is our history in the United States, that Black people will never be seen as human beings. And the history of Black people is that Black people continuously act for white people to see us as human beings, and you white people say, okay, well, when you get to this line, you'll be human. And when we get to that line, we're never fulfilled with that promise. So on that note, I do want to say that I agree with Hillary Clinton in the sense that you cannot change the heart of white people, because Black people in the struggle for freedom have been trying to do it for years. Like, years, we've been trying to change the hearts and the minds for white people to see us as human beings. It's not going to happen. Maybe if we do change laws and policies, in fact, is maybe then that'll begin to change our biases towards Black people and create some type of equality. Is that my hope for the problem? No. I think the system itself needs to be completely redesigned. I think majority of the systems need to be redesigned to include African-Americans as human beings. And even to the point where we are allowed to express anger, because I know within our culture, we are taught how to not express anger and not express sadness, which is two deeply ingrained human emotions that we need to exist. So if I can't ever be angry and I can't ever be sad, then how do I deal with frustration, which is like a combination of both, in my perspective.
Let me touch upon your commentary on what Hillary Clinton said. I agree with her and disagree with her, so let me explain that. I agree with her that you are not going to make white people care about you by, you know, going out there and presenting a passive, you know, I'm out here with my hands up and please see me. I'm a human being just like you and all. You're not going to convince people like that, because it's ingrained in the society. It's so ingrained in the media. Malcolm X talked about how the media it's used to control the minds of people. As long as you have all of this racist propaganda that dominates all forms of media in this country, then I would say that you're fighting an uphill battle in trying to change the general mindset of most white people. Now, can you change hearts and minds? Yes, you can change hearts and minds. There's a number of ways you can do that. Just like, my research over the weekend on empathy. People who have low empathy, meaning that they do not feel for other people, they can't put themselves in another person's shoes and then, you know, feel what that person might have felt. Not to be confused with sympathy. Sympathy is feeling sorry. We don't want people feeling sorry for us. We just want people to empathize and be able to put yourself, you know, in another person's shoes who is not as fortunate as you are, who doesn't have the same social privileges that you have. Now, psychological studies have shown that white people, most white people, not all, most white people cannot empathize, or do not, I'm not going to say cannot, but do not empathize with non-white people. That was a 2010 study on that, and
wow,
and that's been backed up by a number of others. So I think it would be a waste of time trying to convince racists, people who have this implicit bias, and it could even be in their DNA passed down, you know, after so many centuries of living in a white supremacist society. But what we can do is keep those people from becoming police officers, keep those type of people from becoming jurors. I mean, think of the woman who you, the white woman you sat down next to who shuddered. Now imagine her if you were charged with a crime and then she's sitting on your jury. Would you be happy with, you know, with a person like
not,
that?
I wouldn't be happy with that, but I don't know of a way how to keep racist people off of a jury, or how to keep racist people off the police force, or how to keep racist people out of administrative positions that that sometimes control our lives. Like, what tests are people in a white supremacist world, in a Eurocentric world, what tests are white people giving to other white people to see if they're biased? Or what tests are they given to see if they have this racism in them? Like, and why do they care?
Well, again,
and I'm saying, like, in changing hearts and minds, like, how, because people, usually people in power usually don't care about the people who are at the bottom or trying to get to power, because it's all about them and their clique.
Well, that's why you build a movement to get those laws passed and to put those things in place. They're not going to do it willingly, but that's why you force them to do it. You know, you build what is it called? Critical mass, where you have enough. And that's something Hillary Clinton talked about building coalitions, about appealing to a mass movement and forcing these politicians, you know, to implement these policies. And like I said, you can go online and take an empathy test. All right. And I'm working right now to design a racial empathy test. But, you know, I think there is one by Harvard, and they call it, you know, they use the politically correct term implicit bias instead of just calling it racism. They say implicit bias. And so if you can take a test that determines a person has a lack of racial empathy or has an implicit bias, well, you can test all potential jurors with that. And then if they fail the test, well, you know, thank you, but you can go home now. We don't need you, you know, today. Here is some empathy exercises you might want to work on, or you might want to go to your physician and see if you have autism or something like that. So what I'm saying is there are things that we can implement, but again, we have to propose those laws and get the politicians to pass them. It can be done. I believe it can be done.
I believe it can be done too. That honestly sounds like a lot of work.
Of course.
And I mean that in the sense of, because people think that, because movements aren't built over the day, and when we see the civil rights movement in the clips that we've been given K-12, we think that it happened in maybe 24 hours and that was it. And not understanding that the legislative process that you're talking about, that may take maybe 2-3 years of continuously pushing for it to happen.
Well, it could take that, but I mean, you can take it at a piecemeal approach. And again, I'm still researching this, but I mean, even state constitutions guarantee an impartial jury. Well, you're not providing us with an impartial jury. Here is the statistical data. Here is the research to prove that you are not seating impartial juries. Here is the data of the research that shows how you can test for those type of biases. And so, if you want to uphold the Constitution, then you need to implement these steps to keep racially biased people off juries, you know, and that goes both ways.
And I just don't think that if we take this to politician makers or decision makers and say, hey, we want to implement it because, you know, your jurors have been shown to have implicit bias. And here's all the data and statistics, you know, and you have to do this to uphold the Constitution. I don't think they want the system to favor minorities unless they themselves are the minority.
Yeah, but again, I mean, what's the point of being out here in the street and doing work if we are not willing to take on, you know, the hard task. And if we, you know, if we succeed defeat before we've even started. Let me use an example. You know, some of the our activists have been targeting some of the presidential candidates. After the second time Bernie Sanders was targeted, he then hired a juvenile justice activist from the Baltimore area to help him craft policy. And one of the policy initiatives that he says he's going to introduce this legislation. And by the way, you know, we also, I'm also part of what we call the new abolitionist movement, because we say that slavery was never abolished. This is a mass incarceration. This is a continuation of slavery. The 13th Amendment says that slavery and involuntary servitude shall be abolished except for punishment for crime. So that opened up the door right there for the convict leasing program right after the Civil War. Yeah. And then, you know, now what we got is mass incarceration, which, you know, of course, Hillary Clinton played a major role along with her husband in you know, filling up the prisons. And so now one of our activists, his name is Max Parthas, he's in South Carolina, and he just got a meeting with Bernie Sanders' team. And now Bernie Sanders, one of the things that we have talked about in the new abolitionist movement is abolishing private prisons. We want to abolish slavery entirely, but sometimes, you know, you have to fight small battles in the broader war and try to win those battles. And so now Bernie Sanders plans to introduce legislation in September to abolish, make private prisons illegal in the United States. And so that didn't take a year, you know, for you know, abolitionist activists to get him to commit to introducing that legislation. So I'm just saying that you never know how things will go.
And I'm saying you're absolutely right. I don't know how things will go. Like, we don't know the turn of events. It's definitely about getting out there, trying it and making it happen, mm-hmm. and drawing as much attention to it as possible if you can.
Now, let's get to some of the topics you want to talk about. Actually, I'm overdue for my station identification break, and let me get that phone number out to the listeners in case they have any questions. The telephone number, again, I know we got a new number, but hopefully y'all will write it down. It's also posted for you on the website, but the new number for the conference line is 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032 pound. Hit *6 and 1 to comment. You could use the web-based flash phone or hit us up at 704-951-5030. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on the other side of this station identification break.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
And welcome back. Now, Ms. Wilson, let's jump into some of the topics that you wanted to discuss. And let me just read it as it's written. What does liberation of white supremacy look like? Can you explain that further? And what does it look like?
Liberation of white supremacy. I was recently at the Black Lives Matter convening in Cleveland. And that was definitely one of the questions, is what does liberation of white supremacy look like? To me, it personally looks like a community of Black people who accept, love themselves. And though we may have arguments and tensions, like, we're not fighting over basic survival. Like, we're not killing each other for we're not killing each other at all. Like, we have our own, we have sustained our own, and we are loving who we are and thriving. That's what it looks like to me. But that's the question to you also. Like, what do you think liberation looks like? Liberation of white supremacy, what does that look like to you?
Well, the term is kind of confusing to me because, you know, I use the phrase Black liberation. You know, earlier I was talking about the civil rights movement, but, you know, not much is talked about the parallel Black liberation movement, which would include people like Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the Black Liberation Army, such activists as former SNCC activists like H-Rap Brown, now known as Jameel Alameen, Angela Davis, you know, Huey Newton. That's Black liberation. And what I know, what Black liberation looks like to me is Black autonomy, to where we are not dependent upon the greater society to meet our basic needs. That includes the economic aspect, that includes controlling our communities, all aspects of our community, from the education of our children to the policing, so-called policing of our communities, to employment, you know, and black businesses. Yeah. So that's what liberation from white supremacy would look like to me. Black liberation, in my opinion, equals black autonomy.
So you're saying complete black autonomy, like we have control over our spaces completely?
Yes, yes. We have control over the communities that we dominate. Now, does that mean that we isolate ourselves and segregate ourselves? No. Even during Jim Crow segregation, blacks and whites did business with each other. You know, if we can't find a black person to provide a certain resource that we need at that particular moment or time, and so, you know, if we need that resource, we have to get that resource from wherever it's available. But we are always thinking black first. We are first seeking a black source of that resource that we need, that service or whatever it is. So does that clarify it?
I mean, that is an answer to the question. And just to touch on your point, a lot of people don't know that before or during segregation, people were still integrated, that black people did business with white people, mm-hmm. and that white people did do business with black people. Like, even in some of my experiences, people not understanding that biracial children were existing before the end of segregation, that black people and white people were having procreating before integration. Like, that was like a surprise for some of them. And I'm like, I don't understand that. So I didn't understand the surprise. I didn't understand the awe, the shock factor of that. I'm like, because what people are, people procreate. But yes, that does answer my question as far as liberation. What does that look like? That's exactly what it looks like to me over here. And it doesn't mean that we're necessarily segregated.
Just means we have control over our spaces and our infrastructure. Yes. And right now we don't. We don't. Even if you, let's use Detroit, for example, which I'm not. I lived in Detroit from about the age of 3 to about the age of 12. But I was born mm-hmm. down south in North Carolina, where I am now. But even when you had a majority black mayor, black city council, and I mean, we can even see this in Memphis, Tennessee today, where you have all of these black people in positions of power, but racism, white supremacy as an institution is still the order of the day. So simply having the black faces in high places is not going to help if those black people are agents or tools of racism and white supremacy, because they have some measure of self-hatred.
I agree. I think some measure of self-hatred. I would say black people in high places have a lot of measure of self-hatred, and also just control over our religion
mm-hmm.
and who or what we choose to worship, and however we choose to worship it, that freedom. I personally, freedom of dress is, and this is once again, controls over our space, control over our bodies. If I want to wear African garments, that won't be seen as unprofessional.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm working, if I want to have dreadlocks and an afro in my workplace, that won't be seen as unprofessional.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a true acceptance of blackness and understanding that if my hair is curly, that is the natural state of my hair, mm-hmm. and therefore that is not unprofessional, and I'm allowed to work freely and be who I am.
Right, without having to mutilate yourself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In order to fit into society.
Right, right. I agree with you. Let's jump to, and this is a topic that I was talking about yesterday, as, you know, with the release of the film, which I don't even want to watch, not even on bootleg, but MWA, you know, I'm serious. It's posted online right now. I mean, people can watch it online bootleg, but I don't even want to watch it.
I know, but your comment, like, I don't even want to watch it on bootleg. It was the way you said it. It was very funny. the sarcasm.
I don't. I don't even want to see it on bootleg, but, you know, out of that, now people are focusing on Dr. Dre. and the violence that he committed against several females that he was in a abusive relationship with him being the abuser. And so now, you know, that whole issue of domestic violence, once again, you know, is becoming a mainstream topic. At least it should become a mainstream topic. But you know what bothers me? Why is it every time that, you know, not making any excuses because domestic violence is wrong. I don't care who's doing it. But why is it we only had these national conversations when a black person gets accused of it? You know, last time we had this conversation on a national level, it was Ray Rice. All right.
I'll think about it.
Yeah. Now it's Dr. Dre. But, you know, from my research, because I did a lot of research on domestic violence, did a couple of programs, spoke to some experts on it. You know, domestic violence crosses racial, religious, and ethnic and economic lines. This is a problem, period, in all communities. All right. But
agreed.
But is that the type sort of violence that you wanted to talk about that black women are facing, or just violence in general? Because, I mean, they are facing a tremendous amount of violence in this society.
The violence that I was talking about in particular, and I was talking more so about police brutality violence.
Okay.
But the violence about domestic abuse, the violence of sexual abuse, the violence of police brutality, all of that is important violence to talk around the subject that black women are facing. To your question about why is it always highlighted when black men are in, or why does this conversation appear when it's attached to black men? I think it's because it plays back into our implicit bias that black men are very violent.
Mm-hmm.
They're more aggressive and they're more likely to hit someone in order to express their frustration. Do I believe that is true? No, I know for a fact that domestic violence is something like pot smokers or those who smoke marijuana. It's all across the board. In every race and every ethnicity, it's something that happens. I wanted to touch on this issue just because my mother was a victim of domestic violence and my aunt was a victim of police brutality, and we are doing a Say Her Name rally here in Tampa this Friday at 8 p.m. Gaslight Park. But just going up in that situation, because also some of my students from the police school live in abusive situations, and I think that right now, hearing my students have conversations about, especially my male students, about how they just gonna Chris Brown a girl, mm-hmm. or how are they gonna beat a girl up, and how my younger female students are accepting this abuse, like, it has become so common, mm-hmm. that if we took away video games from children, if we took away all the things that distract them, cell phones and TV, they would actually begin to have conversations about how mom got beat up last night.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be like, oh, well, my mom did too. And to just to see how normalized that has become in our society. And I'm very worried about it. And not just at a Dr. Dre moment, like I'm continuously worried about how this violence upon this intra or this internal violence in our community is affecting our children, because we have not been taught. And let me back up, because I want to say some of us have not been taught how to articulate our frustrations in a way that we can verbalize them, so that way we don't have to resort to punching someone in the face in order to say, yo, I'm really mad at you, I need my space, I need to walk off.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of, hey, if you don't want to listen to me, I'm tired of talking, I'm just punching your face, and we're just going to duke it out. Though I agree that was the way we handled things, I'm not saying that don't fight at all, but our fighting is leading us to prison. Like, that's giving people a reason to arrest us. And we just have to find a better way how to deal with our frustration.
Yeah, and the police, impact of that, there's I want to share some statistics with you, but just to touch upon what you said about when it's domestic violence between partners and then the police come in, a lot of times, you know, they make it worse.
Yeah.
For example, there was a couple in Charlotte, two females, and one of them was having, like, she had some kind of mental disorder, like bipolar, but don't hold me to that, but it was some kind of mental disorder, and she got in a fight with her girlfriend, and she had a knife in her hand, and then, so they called the police, and here come the police, and she wouldn't put the knife down, so they shot her and killed her. shot her in her chest,
wow.
You know, and killed her. And so, you know, I have seen that a lot, where there are domestic violence instances, not always between partners, but even between siblings or a parent, yeah, and child, you know, where you have, mm-hmm, adult children. And I've seen, you know, cases again, the one case that comes to my mind where this guy had a bipolar disorder as well. And so his mom called, he had a screwdriver and he wouldn't put it down. So she called the police. And then as soon as he steps out the door, they shoot him down. And then she's screaming and yelling, "Oh, you shot my son." Well, damn, you called him. What did you expect? You know?
Yeah.
What did you expect? For them to come and help? I mean, have you been paying attention? So I think that, you know, domestic violence is an issue that the community itself should work on solving without involving the police. Whether there is a squad of brothers and sisters that, you know, we on call, you know, we work in shifts, and if there's a domestic violence issue, call us. And we'll come in and we'll, you know, separate the person from the situation, try to counsel them or whatever. But I think we just got to quit calling the police so much and thinking we need them to come in and solve our problems.
And I agree with you. But for the sake of conversation, I'm going to disagree. And this is the point I'm going to make. So, since we have not been taught how to de-escalate situations, how then can we come together and separate from the list of injuries of getting cut, of getting shot, of getting stabbed, all for the sake of our brothers and sisters who have yet to learn that we're supposed to be loving and supporting each other? But if we call in a white man to come fix our problems, that's simple. You know, like, there ain't no words to that.
Well, we had to be careful that we, you know, and I do this myself. I'm constantly trying to improve upon myself, but we had to be careful when we engage in stereotypes of our community. This is something that the Black Panther Party and other revolutionary organizations, this is one of the things that they did, is that they did intervene in domestic violence situations. I've talked to some of these activists. Oh, they're elders now, you know, and that was, mm-hmm, one of the things that they did. You know, obviously the people that would volunteer for such a thing, let's call it an intervention team, domestic violence intervention team, obviously we would get those people training, you know, on de-escalating situation. We wouldn't want to send someone in a situation and they are not equipped with the skills to handle a situation like that.
I mean, we talk about the Black Panther Party, but Huey P. Newton was a domestic abusive person. So saying that that program came out of the Black Panther Party is kind of like ironic to say, because wasn't he like a big cokehead and a big domestic abuser according to the
I think he may have gotten into those things later in his life, but you do realize that the Black Panther Party had thousands of members nationwide, and that we cannot attribute the actions of an individual to discredit the entire movement.
I agree.
Domestic violence. Okay, I wanted to talk about that. Now, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about it in terms of police using violence against women. We just saw, you know, the excessive force used on Sandra Bland in that video. Mm-hmm. We have seen videos of homeless women on the highway in California being beaten MMA style by a police officer or a CHP officer. So, I think it is also important to point out, and I'm going to read from the freethoughtproject.com, but there are other sources as well. Law enforcement officers beat their significant other at nearly double the national average. Several studies, according to Diane Wittendorf, author of Police Domestic Violence Handbook for Victims, indicate that women suffer domestic abuse in at least 40% of police officer families. For American women overall, regardless of race, the figure is 25%, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So that's nearly double the national rate that police officers are engaged in domestic violence. So once you know that, then it should come as no surprise that when they get out here in the streets that they don't have a problem using violence against anyone, let alone women.
Yeah.
Were you women aware of that? Were you aware of that?
Was I aware of that police officers have high statistics of abusing women in their actual households?
Yes.
Than other people?
Yes.
No, I was not aware of that, but that does not come as a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
I know in particular the case that we worked on here in Florida, Tampa area, was Brittany Overstreet, mm-hmm. an 18-year-old girl, very small, who was slammed by the police officer and fractured both sides of her jaw.
Mm-hmm.
The police officer said that he was scared and he was trying to get her under control.
Mm-hmm.
So he pretty much slammed her once. She became unconscious and slammed her again until she stopped moving.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, from my conversations with her, she was like, she didn't remember the second slam. She didn't actually remember what happened. She just remembers crying in the SRO officer and in his little cubbyhole. Her mother was not notified. A friend that works at the school who knew her mother had to call her. And even then, like, they wouldn't let her go and see her child. So that's just an interesting thing that Florida schools are facing, how parents are cut off from their children and what actually happens when children are interacting with SRO officers or police officers in school. Parents will not be notified if that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as police violence, I'm not surprised at that at all. It's become apparent that that police officers are an unchecked authority in the United States system. And these are, once again, the reported cases. These aren't the unreported cases. So
right.
These could be higher.
Right. It's very important that you made that distinction, because the researcher Diane Wittendorf, when I look further at her resources, her research, she said that 40% is probably understated, because a lot of these women are afraid to report these cops, because when they've reported them in the past, their buddies will come, other cops will show up, and they'll be like,
yeah,
you don't want to file that complaint. No, we'll talk to him and this and that. And so they're afraid. They're afraid because how are you going to report a police officer to another police officer when they act like a gang?
And that's what, if the police officer, and back to my statement, the police system, our authoritative system, goes unchecked. Like, no one can check the police. So if they do a crime, or when they commit crimes, who puts them in jail? Like, who holds them accountable? And then when we go to our legislative systems or our politicians asking for accountability for police officers, it's usually this whole talk letter thing, yeah. But no one actually puts their words to action. And I think it's become I think truly to burn something down, when you get to that point in your frustration,
mm-hmm.
when you get to the point of rebellion,
mm-hmm.
you have exhausted all elements at that point. Like, you try talking, you
mm-hmm.
try protesting, you try appealing to politicians, you try talking to whoever decides laws, whoever makes decisions, and no one has heard you, because still in our implicit bias, Black lives have no value in the United States. Black lives have no voices. So, and until we can get to the point where Black lives have power, Black lives have voices, I think this is where the movement is going to, like, trying to instill power and voices behind the faces of Black people, so that way they can be heard and seen for this new generation coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're tired. I don't know how much longer we can ask for freedom if we've been asking for it since 1960 and before 1960.
Right. Right. Sometimes, you know, like Malcolm X has said, sometimes that's the only language that the oppressor understands is violence. So, I mean, we're dealing with a very violent society, and so sometimes, you know, they don't take you serious until there are expressions of violence. I neither condone nor condemn violence for the very reasons that you said. You know, how do I know that person probably went and filed all these complaints and went to, you know, their representative and did everything that they're told to do, you know, and then at the end of the day, you know, still no justice. So, I mean, what's a person to do? You know, what's a person to do? All right. I mean, you look at, you know, pre 1865 slavery, prior to the Civil War, you had a lot of abolitionists and stuff begging politicians, and y'all know this is wrong. This is a violation of these people's human rights. You know, we need to change the Constitution. We need to end slavery. Hell, it took a civil war to end that period of enslavement. All right. It took black people picking up arms, you know, joining the Union Army or fighting as contraband with the Union Army to end that period of slavery. Unfortunately, they pulled the lawyer's trick on us and they put an exception clause in the 13th Amendment, which they told the world abolishes slavery when it actually makes it legal as punishment for a crime. Let's move on to a couple of more topics. You mentioned self-care. What do you mean in terms of self-care? Black people taking care, better care of themselves, you know, health-wise, psychologically.
Health-wise, psychologically. I know as activists in this movement, we give so much energy towards the cause and our people that we often forget to take care of ourselves as far as health-wise, economically, spiritually, making sure that we are first okay, and then going out to help our communities. Usually it's just making sure that the community is safe, that the work we're doing is safe, and then we come last. Because some of us have been taught to be very selfless, but realizing that our selflessness will also lead to our self-crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And if we die, like, who continues the work?
Mm-hmm.
Always the question.
Sound like you're saying, you know, if people not careful, they'll get burnt out on the work.
Yeah.
If they don't maintain
their
own health. And then also looking at it from another perspective, they could damage their family relations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you there. That does fall under, you know, area of that we do need to pay more attention to. Of course, you know, a lot of people touted Obamacare as a way for black people to get access to the medical care that they need. I'm not so sure. I'm not sold on Obamacare or whatever. We'll see. But, you know, that again, talking about the Black Panther parties, can you tell they got a strong influence on me?
I can tell. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah, but the first free public health clinics to start in this country were started by the Black Panther Party. Sickle cell testing, which affects primarily non-white people, primarily black people, but also Hispanics and people in certain parts of Europe, ethnic people. But the first sickle cell testing was developed by the Black Panther Party. And so, you know, again, this goes back to the original question that you asked about what does, you know, liberation from white supremacy look like? Well, that's what it looks like to me, to where we are able to open up medical clinics in our own communities and meet the medical needs of our own people and not rely on, you know, the United States government or anyone else to meet our people's needs. Cause certainly we got plenty of smart people. We got plenty of doctors in our community. And so I think that's an area we could do better at.
I do agree with you, but even the doctors and all the brilliant minds that we have in our community, we have to first tell them that they're brilliant and that they can make it. Like our doctors, our current doctors, I think they've broken too much of the Kool-Aid and have forgotten about us down here.
Mm-hmm. We really need them. One of the solutions I'm hoping you may have heard about you're down there in Florida. The recent normalization of diplomatic ties with Cuba. Cuba has the best healthcare system in the world. They have a program. I just interviewed somebody about it a few months ago, but they have a program where students can go and study medicine free, tuition free, and to pay for their education in the medical field is they have to commit a certain number of years to go back to the community and you know, provide community health services. That's how they pay it forward, you know, is by going back. And so now with the normalization of relations with Cuba, I'm hoping that it'll make it just that much easier for non-white children to get access to that kind of education. And then, you know, to come back and bring that asset back to our communities. I'm hoping. Okay.
I'm That'd be an awesome change.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
I'm with you. I'm hoping too, but I don't know.
Let me take another station identification break, and then when we come back, we'll touch upon this last subject, which I think all of them are important, but I think this is primarily important when it comes to future generations, and that is, you know, children being raised in oppressive environments. So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News, broadcasting every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday right here on blacktalkradionetwork.com. The telephone number to get in on the conference line is 641-715-3660. That's 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Again, that's 549-032-POUND. But those already dialed in. If you want to chime in, just hit *6 and 1. Use the web-based flash phone as well. And you can hit us on the studio line, 704-951-5030. We are in conversation with Ms. Crystal Wilson, and we'll be right back.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The police the same way. They put this club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim. And then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him. This is American justice. This is American democracy.
We have to begin to move to control our community. Everything that's in your community that you don't control is a weapon against you. Public education as it exists today is a weapon against black people. TV and news media, especially the WPP, white power press, white people's paper, and white people's power, are enemies against black people. What the white press does is that it makes black people an enemy of black people.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in for this broadcast from behind these enemy lines. We are joined in conversation today by Crystal J. Wilson, who is a Bay Area activist, the founder of the Bay Area Activist Coalition, which is based out of Tampa Bay, Florida. We've been having a very insightful conversation with her thus far, and we're going to touch upon this last topic and talk about the impact of oppressive environments on children. And of course, we are speaking primarily of black children, but I imagine the results are the same on any non-white child. Also, just to let you know, again, if you have a question or comment, hit us up, 641-715-3660. Participant code 549-032-POUND, hit *6 and 1 to comment on air. So, Ms. Wilson, please lead us into this last segment on the impact of oppressive environments on children.
I don't mind leading you into that segment. Just give me 1 second to clarify because I don't want my squad to turn up on me. I'm one of the founding members of Bay Area Activist Coalition. It is a group of us. So I know, I think they'll be pretty upset. But going into this conversation about the environment of oppressive children, or children in an oppressive environment, I did free school, and what free school was inspired by the Black Panthers, one of their campaigns, of course. So I got African-American children together, Black, Latino, African-American children, and put them together. And what I realized is that when children are in environments of white supremacy, if I have 10 minority children or more, and if we're interacting with our environment, we are immediately policed by a white person, or we are actually being told what to do by an officer themselves. For example, we were at the school board. We were finna go talk before school board elected officials. And one of my students was, she's 8. She ran downstairs to quickly tell her brother something. Immediately, maybe 2 minutes later, the police officer comes out and was like, "You guys have to move. I can't have her running up and down the stairs." And I was like, she didn't run up and down the stairs. She just run down the stairs one time to tell her brother something. Well, you know, you guys are blocking the stairway. So, you know, you have to move. So it was like, okay. We move. Then we move by making them practice their speeches. She's practicing her speech, and then the officer comes back out. She's jumping up and down. She's jumping in the chair because she's 8. I tell her to sit down. She's getting ready to sit down. As soon as she gets ready to sit down, the officer walks out and tells her, "You know, you need to sit down." He's like, "You know, I'm not trying to tell you what to do. You know, I just care. I don't want you to hurt yourself." But that has been our experience. Every time we go out in the community, and it's usually when we have 10 or more, African-American children or Black children, and for some reason it's like Black children are not allowed to be children, not allowed to play with things. So I'm wondering, how is it that we are actually raising our children in this oppressive environment? And also, I noticed that my children are suffering with a lot of inward trauma, usually because mom is oppressed, she then in return oppresses the kids, and allowing them to be free in an oppressive environment was one of the difficulties that I faced. Because soon it became, they don't want to write. I'm like, "So you want to be free from writing? You ain't got to write. You want to read? You want to be free from reading? You ain't got to read." And allowing them to talk and actually have conversations amongst themselves and organize themselves. One of the greatest things about free school, the best results, is that at the end, my children were organizing their own ride to the program. So that was amazing in itself. But just how are we raising children in this oppressive environment, and how are we actually giving them freedom and liberty that they need to be children and to grow up as thinking individuals and actually learn how to operate in this system?
You know, when you mentioned that this primarily happens when there are, did you say 10 or more of you? When there's a group of you,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, maybe 2 or 3. But when there's a group of 10 or more of you, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was one of the original missions of the police. You know, you do know the police came out of the slave catchers, right? The slave patrols, paddy rollers, and whatnot. The first police department was created in the mid-1600s. So you have police departments like Boston Police Department, like the New York City Police Department. They are older than the United States itself, because the United States did not incorporate as a nation corporation until 1775. And so police are old. The institution of police and Black people is older than the United States itself. Now, a lot of people, we like to just think about, you know, pre-1865 or pre-Civil War. We like to think, I should say that I have observed that there seems to be this perception that all Black people in this country were enslaved, when that's not true. There were a half a million free Black persons counted in the 1850 census, which was 15 years before, you know, the end of the Civil War. But those people were experiencing Jim Crow before someone named Jim Crow, you know, the period after the Civil War. And one of the things that they were prevented from doing was congregating in public, in you know, in the groups, in groups like you just described. 10 or more, you know, people out here. Oh, what are y'all black people doing out here talking and all it? No, no, no. Disperse this crowd and go about your separate ways. And so, I mean, that's part of daily life of black people. I mean, that has been their experience ever since the creation of police forces in this country.
And I understand that completely. But right now we are in 2015.
Okay.
2015. And I just really want to believe that my students are allowed to congregate amongst themselves without police interference or interference by a white person. Like, my kids were not uncontrollably, unruly. They were children. And getting one of the campaigns down here that we're working on is Kids Not Criminals. And getting people in Tampa to see that black kids are not criminals, they're children. Like, they touch things, they jump on chairs, they want to interact with the environment, they want to know how things are. Like, I had a student who had never been to Subway. Like, the first time she went to Subway was me taking her. And I was like, okay, so there are other problems, like, inside the community that we have to address, but if we're not allowed to interact with the environment, how can we address it? If we're not allowed to interact with the environment without being policed, how can we actually fix the issues that we're having in the community?
Like H-Rap Brown just said in that clip that I played, and my whole reason is, see, we had to connect this to the history to see the reason that I like looking back to the past is to see not how great we are, to see, you know, oh, this black person invented a hot iron, or this was a first black millionaire. I study black history, mm-hmm. in this country in terms of what mistakes did we make. How far have we come in this movement, this centuries old movement for black liberation in this country? And so sometimes in order to understand a problem, you got to understand the history of that problem, the root causes, where does it stem from? And so that, again, that is the same treatment. That's why I tell people, that's why I feel the civil rights movement was a failure. Because if the civil rights movement was so successful, then why are we still dealing with these same issues, you know, 40 years later? You know, it seems like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I would definitely agree with you. The civil rights movement, people thought that the civil rights movement, still think that the civil rights movement was the end-all, be-all, it just fixed all the problems for black people. And the only thing that it gave us was the power to vote.
And that's being challenged right now.
Yeah, in the South, not in the North, because they could vote in the North, in the South, primarily the South. But it didn't address the economic problems that we were facing. It didn't address the police brutality issues that we were facing. It did not address our existence as a whole in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And since people saw that, they just kind of fled and was like, oh, okay, that's the end of racism. And it's like, no.
Mm-hmm.
And so me personally, I was like, for my mother's generation, I'm like, you dropped the ball. Now, mm-hmm. I got to go get up here, and I got to go to take to the streets, and I got to pick up where you left off. And while you have deluded my brain and made me believe that there is no racism, that it's over, now I have to come back up and say, like, all these emotions that I've been feeling, all these clues that I've been getting throughout K-12, even in college, is indeed racism. And I've been telling you that, and you've been telling me I'm wrong.
Well, the reason that I like playing those sound bites from some of the past activists of the day, like H-Rap Brown, who came out of SNCC before joining the Black Panther Party, what did he say? He said, anything you don't control in your community is a weapon against you. Black people do not control the police in your community, and that's why black children cannot be in public spaces without being harassed by anyone. That's the root cause right there. We don't control them.
And I think that's just that. Like, I had to tell one of my students, because I was thinking about Tamir Rice's name is Jeremiah. Jeremiah wanted to know, why could he not go to the park and play with a water gun? And I didn't know what to tell him. He's four. What? And I've been trying to think, listening to America's reactions on unarmed black men being murdered by the police, of all of them being thugs. You know, the women that interrupted Bernie Sanders, you know, they were just manly women, uneducated, didn't know what they were doing. And all this disrespect. But I'm like, I have yet to see another person get up, disrupt the political space, and get the answers that they deserve, like the courage that that takes. Like, people should have been giving those women hand claps, applause. They should be getting, like, prizes all over the, across the board. But America's reaction to Black people stepping in and demanding control, the control that they deserve, is usually, like, I just can't believe that. Like, you know, Black people, Bernie Sanders is the only one who can save you. And I'm like, I don't even want to deal with Bernie Sanders just because his supporters, not necessarily Bernie Sanders himself, his supporters are heavily racist, or they have their implicit bias of how Black people should react to their candidate. And I'm like, how can you tell me how I should react to my candidate when I'm sitting here watching your reactions to the unarmed Black men and to these unarmed Black women and children being murdered in the streets, and you're telling me that their lives were not important, that their lives didn't matter because of very small things that had nothing to do with them actually being murdered. So, and I'm dealing with these kids, and it became very emotional at times. Like, there were times when I just let them play the whole day so that way they could be free, so they can actually have a childhood. I let them argue, and I intervene into the argument, telling them that we have to love, support, and protect each other because we're all we have. Mm-hmm. And trying to reprogram them, send them back into their environments, and then they come back to me and reprogram them all over again. Like, when I'm saying, like, we're facing an oppressive structure, I don't know how our children can actually be free in this environment when everything around us is oppressive.
Black autonomy. That's the only way. That's the only logical answer to that question you just asked. How can our children be free of these oppressive environments? Black autonomy. Black community control of your own community. Now, in terms of the activists who interrupted Bernie Sanders, we also have to be able to accept constructive criticism. But I do agree that most of the criticism coming from mainstream America and others, even including Black people, was racist in nature. I was just writing about that yesterday. It was just in June that a transgendered immigration activist interrupted President Obama and Joe Biden at a celebration for LGBT rights or something like that. I do remember Michelle Obama being interrupted by Code Pink. You heard of Code Pink? They're like,
yeah, I heard of Code Pink.
Yeah, they're anti-war activists. Code Pink, mm-hmm. Not that long ago, it may have been towards the end of last year, barged into a congressional hearing where the war criminal, Henry Kissinger was going to be speaking, a former, you know, Secretary of State, racist white supremacist. They were confronting him at this congressional hearing, and they interrupted it. They didn't care nothing about the rules and the procedures and stuff like that. So it is not like these activists who are interrupting these presidential candidates are the first to do it, and they won't be the last. But I think the criticism that has been leveled towards them has been overtly racist, in my opinion.
I agree with you, and I just, it's gotten really sad to the point where I'm like, to a point, what segregation gave Black America, and I'm not saying segregation was awesome, I at least knew who racist people were. Now, I don't know who a racist person is. I'm like, so I could be sitting next to you, and you could be racist, and you could still be smiling in my face.
Could I suggest a resource for you to help you?
Sure. I take resources.
We have a media partner that broadcasts on Black Talk Radio Network. The name of the program, and it's also a digital, independent digital radio station through our network. It's called The Context of White Supremacy. And, you know, that is all they do is talk about and analyze racism and white supremacy. They interview a lot of white people and ask them questions about racism. The short answer to your question, how do I know this white person I'm dealing with is racist or not? By asking questions. and ask them questions in a codified manner. You don't want to just simply come out and ask them, are you racist? You know, because what do you think the answer going to be to that? You know, but you develop. But you develop questions that will help you determine whether this person has. Hell, you can borrow some of the questions from the implicit bias test. You know what I'm saying? That test people for empathy. Borrow some of those. So that's the way, by asking questions, that's the biggest takeaway I got from the cows. Is that, you know, you ask these white supremacist questions. If you want to understand racism, white supremacy, how it works, ask the people who are expert at it. But ask these questions in a codified manner. Saturday nights in particular, which we pick up that broadcast on Saturday nights at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, is the compensatory call-in. It starts off by playing news clips, and then callers are encouraged to call in to analyze those clips or to share anything else that has happened to them personally or they have observed during the week that involves racism. And then, you know, giving each other suggestions on how to deal with racists that may be on a job, that may be in the classroom, that, you know, in all walks of life. So I like to suggest that resource to you. It's called, again, The Context of White Supremacy.
I definitely have The Context of White Supremacy Saturday at 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Saturday nights at 9 p.m. Compensatory call-in. We got a caller. You up to take a phone call as we get ready to close out your segment?
Just to let you know, if I am disconnected, my phone has died. It wasn't
okay.
Because I left.
All right. Okay. We'll make it quick. Area code 678. Please go ahead with your question or comment for our guest.
All right. Peace, Brother Scotty. Also, peace to you, Sister Crystal. It's been a lively discussion. I just, as far as what we mentioned about people coming in to the community and options outside of the police, I don't know much about this organization, but I did hear of this on the Black Agenda Report, a group called the National Black Defenders. I tried looking them up, but their website seems to be down as of the last couple of days. But they're based out of Milwaukee, and they seem to be doing that kind of work as far as de-escalating
domestic violence
in the Black community.
Say that again. The Black Defenders, is that what it's called?
Yes, the National Black Defenders, and they have an Instagram that's up. Their website seems to be down, though.
That's great to hear that somebody's doing that work.
Okay.
Maybe they need to be encouraged to continue and to expand their work into more communities. Thanks. Did you have anything else you would like to share?
No, so that's it, and just appreciate the work. And I also wanted to definitely point toward my support of this notion of the sensitivity testing. I feel like that's absolutely constructive and would be welcome to this so-called justice system.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your views and sharing that resource with us. And you have a blessed day, all right? Be safe behind these enemy lines.
You as well. Appreciate that.
All right, let me clear the caller's queue.
Q&A queue is cleared.
All right. Well, before your phone dies, did you want to respond to what the caller had to say, or did you want to share any final thoughts and give out any websites, contact information that you would like to share?
Definitely. I want to thank the caller for calling in. I do appreciate that. We're definitely going to look into the National Black Defenders to see how they can help us here in Tampa Bay, Florida. If you want to follow us, please follow us at Bay Area Activist Coalition. That's BAAC/_Florida. We have a Twitter, an Instagram, and a Facebook page just like that.
Mm-hmm.
BAAC_FL.
Mm-hmm.
So please follow us. Please keep us encouraged. We need it. And we need community support. Right? We need national community support in order to continue this work because it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
As you know.
Yeah, I do have one more question, because I almost forgot. But I had read about a case in Florida. I'm not sure of the city, but do you recall the case where the homeless man had like a stick and he was at a public park and they gunned him down in front of all those children. Do you remember that? It just happened.
No, when did it happen?
It happened this year. I want to say in the past month or two, and I hadn't heard anything else. But this homeless man, you know, he had like some kind of metal stick. He probably used it to keep dogs off of him or something like that. And he was in the park, and it was a lot of children at this park. And so the police were, you know, from the witness statements, were really harassing him. And so he had raised the stick above his head, but they said that he never swung it at anyone. But regardless, you know, he got a stick. And then you got guns, and then you just shoot them down and kill them in front of all those children like that. I'll try to look up that story, and I'll send it to you if I can find it.
Yes, I haven't heard that story. Please send it to me, and we will probably get some people looking into that right away. The latest story that we've heard of was that a homeless man in Sarasota, the police threw food at him, and we have people working on that case.
I saw that. Mm-hmm.
And then Clark happened here in Tampa. Mm-hmm. Rodney Mitchell died in Sarasota as well, and we're planning a march for him from Sarasota to Tampa.
Is he the one that was tased to death?
Rodney Mitchell was not tased to death. That was Arthur Green. Arthur Green was tased to death, and he was having a diabetic coma.
Okay.
A diabetic attack.
Okay.
It's been a lot of deaths in Tampa and Tampa, St. Pete, Manatee County, and Sarasota County. It's been a lot going on.
Mm.
And trying to manage all of that has been difficult as well.
Okay. Well, anything that our media network, because we are a nonprofit based out of North Carolina, Black Talk Media Project, our main mission is to help raise the voices of Black people. So that they can speak, you know, about their issues unabashedly, you know, without censorship and whatnot. So anything that we can do to help get out any information, the door is wide open for you or one of your comrades to come on the program if y'all feel like, you know, there's a story that needs to be told and we want y'all to know about it. So please don't hesitate, you know, to use us as a media resource. And I want to thank you again. First of all, for being the person that you are and being a empathetic person who cares about people in her community and not only caring, but, you know, putting action behind that. So I want to thank you for being who you are. And I just want to wish you safety behind these enemy lines and much success in the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it very much. Say is thank you, because it's just thank you, because I can't do it without the people. So the people are what's important.
Most certainly. Well, Miss Wilson, you have a blessed day, and again, you be safe. Okay.
All right.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye.
Okay, so that concludes our interview, and let me see here.
This service is provided in high definition by free conference call HD.com. Present. Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
Sorry, I got disconnected from the conference line. Something is going on with Skype. Let's see what is going on here. Testing my chat. Okay, what is going on here? If you can hear me and you're in the conference line, just hold on. I'm going to hang up and call back in, and Skype is tripping. Area code 914.
Attention, this is not a...
Okay, now I'm getting hit with the telemarketers and whatnot. Skype, I should never have allowed it to update itself because now it's tripping. It's just, man, let me call back into the conference line because we had people hanging on in there. Let me see. Here is the right number right here. Okay. Y'all bear with me, listeners, as I work through these technical issues.
This service... Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
All right. I think I found the problem.
Muted.
Let's see.
Goodbye.
Okay, I might have to reset the conference line. I'm sorry if people were dialed in there and you got hung up on. I know you can't hear me, but y'all bear with me. I see the problem. Like somehow Skype opened, called in several times to the same line.
This service is provided in high definition. Incorrect access code. Please re-enter your access code followed by the pound.
Okay, that's the wrong number. Man, Skype is getting aggravating. Let's see, free conference. Make sure this is the right profile. All right, that's the right one. Okay, let's call it again. Sorry about that. 641. That's wrong. Now, we're getting ready to take a music break while I handle this, and then
this service
we'll come
is provided
back.
In high definition by free conference call. Access code accepted. This conference is being recorded. Q&A session started.
Okay, we are back. We are back. Sorry about that. Skype, I updated it, and it's doing some crazy things now. When sometimes when I get calls, and somehow it had called into made several calls into the conference line, and that's why I was hearing that echo. But I'm gonna take a station identification break, play some message music, and when I come back, I want to jump on these articles that were written by Barbara Reynolds as well as Dr. Ben Carson. I'm very disappointed. I'm not surprised because I know the prevalence of proxy racism in this country and black self-hatred. And so I will analyze, share those articles with you and analyze them. Yeah, it's just truly sad when we, and I think Carson is around my age. And, but this woman, I think she's like my mom's age. So she will be in her 60s or her 70s. And for her to pen, attack piece on these young black protesters for a white supremacist website like the Washington Post. I mean, she should be ashamed of herself. She should be ashamed of herself. But I want to highlight this because proxy racism is a problem. Not to attack her because she's suffering. She a victim. Okay. But so that we can analyze these things, so that we can have these conversations, so that we can try to redeem these people. But sometimes, you know, some people, they are just unredeemable. But, you know, this is out there in the propaganda sphere right now, and we have to deal with it. We have to deal with it. And it's just so sad when we just can't worry about just dealing with the races at Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. We got to deal with people who look like us using those platforms to levy attacks on us for the system. It's just sad. And then a lot of times, they don't even realize that's what they're doing. A lot of this stuff is unconscious. They're on autopilot from the anti-black chip that has been embedded in their brains. So don't think that just simply white people are impacted by racist media and racist society. Okay, black people are as well. And I'll tell you, I've met too many black people to be comfortable with that have a lot of anti-blackness, you know. So yeah, we want to help them. We got to analyze the problem before we can come up with a solution to help these people. But yeah, so we'll talk about that on the other side. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting behind these enemy lines called USA Inc., this nation corporation that was incorporated in 1775. Yeah, we'll be back, right on the other side.
May appear a confusing blur of activity, each ant doing its own thing, but it can't be. Somehow the ants coordinate their actions so that large insects are overwhelmed, killed, and carried back to the base.
My peers is dying and my people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budgeting.
Just watch what comes out your mouth.
People are suffering. It's elementary, they want us all gone eventually. Peers is dying, people are suffering. The money's still low, you should see how they budgeting. Peers is dying and my people are suffering. The money's still low, they want us all gone eventually.
What a guy living in this economy like a robbery. The government taxing me when they owe me for my property. You niggas act like you happy to live in poverty. When I feel like a king, they gotta make these fools acknowledge me. I'm royalty and loyal to the feeling of it. Contrast make us look thuggish. We talk, walk, and look rugged. Naturally, nothing sad to see. We all a part of this tragedy. I'm mad at you, so why you mad at me?
We headed for the times of the nine. Watch out, six. Sun cycle on the rise. Moon cycle out the mix. Living on this planet of the snakes and the crucifix. Pardon yourself as I unk my way through. Marching with my head, boom, boom, making my debut. Like great balls. Fire, nothing can save you in these replenishing times. I honor my dead, making my ancestors proud when it's off with your head.
Does my pencil possess potential to change mental? Yes, short with a pen in this pack with the essential lead. What is essential to keep it? The sharpest against you, yes. What is essential to keep it like a temple? Blast, alter the temple, keeping the beat simple and fresh. While they whimper and rest, I'm intuition like the simplest guess. Into tradition, I'm on a mission until I transition to give the up and coming a better existence.
I see the regular form reaching for a point of truth. The older we get, it switches up the point of view. And they anointed you, leader of the free world. Desolate minds refined to the B-girl. The most benevolent is evident who I be. Graffiti on the wall, the crew, Drew Ali. Suits who I keep shifting on the paradigm. Raise the vibration, then go prepare the mind.
Divine, magnificent, red chim. Sit deep, the omnipotent, all-seeing. I just speak the game plan. I pray for niggas, amen. That sharpie spray can I made man. With sway fans, no street skating, no beat taking. For Pete's sake, he's a beast quaking, the scene shaking. No mistaking, the ants conquer the elephants. FTTRBG, the rest of the fellas.
What's the ant secret that makes them the most efficient predators on Earth? Consuming more meat than lions, tigers, and wolves combined.
I'm way medicated, puff lying, lace sedated. It's way dedicated to culture that created the essence of the lessons now delivered in my presence. Kalanji called upon me, so now I pose the question. How is it that the black name in whips and chains, having nothing else to lose and everything to gain? Now niggas entertained for some whips and chains, a white name and some pain.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. I'm going to cut that short. That was FTP. Out of the FTP movement, Atlanta-based rappers, underground hip-hop rappers. And, yeah, that was, what is the name of that track? I forget the name of that track. Anyway, if you come to me, I'll remind you, because I know people like to know, well, what is that music you be playing, Scotty? And so I try to tell you, you know, what Wrath of the CI Foo, that's what it is. Wrath of the CI Foo, that's the FTP movement. Check out the video. It's a very great video. You can find it on YouTube. So I'm going to try to go through these real quick. I'm not going to spend too much time on Barbara Reynolds' post, except to say, you know, she did not have to go there where she started talking about, you know, I'm looking on TV and I'm seeing people with their pants sagging and all that. And then, you know, just petty crap. Just petty crap, man. And see, this is why, you know, we had ran that campaign on Facebook when, you know, the issue was all of these sagging laws, passing laws to target black people for sagging. And while I am no fan of sagging or whatnot, I know where it comes from. It comes from mainstream corporate media. They, you know, they showcase these black rappers like Lil Wayne and stuff, and, you know, they dress however they want to dress, and they come up with these styles and whatnot, and then the youth pick up on it. Now, you know, isn't there a better way that we can solve the problem? And it's not like it's a huge problem. It's not every day I go out my house that I see black kids sagging their pants. It's not. It's not. Okay, so people are overblowing that problem, just like, you know, they overblew problems in the black community that were present in other communities. But to target the black community with these three strikes you out laws and crack cocaine versus powder disparities and all of that, I saw that legislation as another form of the black codes. You know, we're going to pass this law against sagging. And, you know, write you tickets to, you know, extort money out of your community. You know, Ferguson is America. That series that they do every week on New Abolitionist Radio, showing, you know, the same pattern and practices. And that's one of the practices that they do. They come up with these laws, and while they are written in non-racial language, the way that the police implement those laws is to target black people. And so for her, she sound like one of those people that will be behind those laws, you know. Yeah, and I was happy that the NAACP group, speaking of Florida again, I remember it was a Florida town that was going to pass those laws where they had passed the law. And then they came out against it because they was like, look at these white men running around in Speedos, cutting their grass and out in public in their Speedos down here in Florida. And you want to target black kids with about sagging and whatnot. So, you know, this is, she's dealing a whole lot in this respectability, politics. This is what she wrote. The 1960 movement also had an innate respectability because our leaders often were heads of the black church as well. Unfortunately, church and spirituality are not high priorities for quote unquote Black Lives Matter, and the ethics of love, forgiveness, and reconciliation that empower black leaders such as King and Nelson Mandela in their successful quest to win over their oppressors are missing from this movement. Excuse me, but Dr. King was assassinated by the United States government. That was admitted in a lawsuit that the King family filed, a civil lawsuit, and the jury determined that the United States government played a role in the plot to assassinate him. The FBI was also involved in the plot to assassinate Malcolm X. I noticed she didn't mention Malcolm X. He was a minister as well. But he wasn't out there talking about, oh, I love my enemy and I forgive you for lynching me and blowing up my church and, you know, let's be friends and all that BS. You know what I'm saying? And then Nelson Mandela, hell, it was only because of the movement during the 80s that Nelson Mandela got out of prison. And then he had to make concessions to the white supremacists to even get out of prison and become the president of South Africa. So see, this is why it is important to study movements. This is important to study history, because then, you know, people will just put stuff out there and it is non-factual and you'll just be eating it up because you're uninformed. This woman is engaging in lies, you know. And simply cause these kids, I mean, it ain't like all of these young people are out there burning down this and burning down that. But I would point out that there were a lot of so-called quote unquote race riots that were sparked by police brutality in the 1960s. Detroit, Watts, Baltimore, a number of cities across the United States were burnt down. You know, not entirely burnt down to the ground, but the business districts were targeted. And there's this old myth, oh, black people burning down their own communities. No, the hell they ain't. They ain't burning down their own houses. They ain't burning down their apartment buildings, wherever they live. No, the people who are engaging in that type of activity are targeting symbols of the establishment. And certainly the business community supports the police. All right. They support the police through the commerce and whatnot. You know, the chamber of commerce. That's the word I'm looking for. And so, you know, this is just, then she mentions, oh, you know, these church members forgiving the racist terrorists, Dylann Roof, before their loved ones' bodies were even, you know, put in the ground and stuff like that. So, you know, this woman needs to go have a seat. And then she later names people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson as leaders, people who should be leading this new movement. Yeah, the same ones taking money from white corporations that have been practicing racism in their business practices against black people. You mean those type of leaders? See, this is why the young people, and I don't blame them, rejected Al Sharpton when he went to Ferguson. All right, because it's nothing but a circus that follows them. They rejected them. And then this also, people like this woman also dismisses the fact that there was an armed part of the civil rights movement as well. And that, you know, I've talked about it before during Dr. King's last march, the March Against Fear, where a black man had been shot down while he was, you know, doing a multi-state march on the public highway to raise awareness of, about voting, about black voting, and a white racist shot him. They didn't kill him, but, you know, he got hospitalized. And so Dr. King, members of SNCC, took up the march. It was called a March Against Fear. It was in Tennessee, and I think they were marching to Mississippi or somewhere like that. But anyway, and then the young people who are involved in SNCC at that time said, look, we are not going to ask our people to go out here without any kind of defense, you know, to just to have them shot down just like that, man. So this is what we want to do. We want to bring in the brothers from the Deacons for Defense, you know, former members of the United States military, former war veterans, black war veterans who have set up this multi-state, you know, organization of armed self-defense to support their communities. Please check out the book, Protect Their Communities. Please check out the book, We Will Shoot Back. The other book to check out that came out last year is How Guns Saved the Civil Rights Movement. So, see, this woman is engaged in respectability politics, but she's also engaged in deception and telling lies. Dr. King had a house full of guns, all right? Those people that were tasked with being his bodyguards, armed, okay? They were armed. So this is what real, this is, you can may tell in my voice that I'm pissed off. I get pissed off at this sort of attacking black people, the white supremacists attacking black people by using proxy racist tools. And then these black people, you would think with her age, she would know better. But see, no, she doesn't. Apparently, she doesn't know better. Now, there should be no movement or any individual that is above criticism, but is that criticism constructive? And I don't think using racial stereotypes, using racist dog whistles to demonize these young people who are a part of this new movement, you know, which is a continuation of black liberation that started centuries ago on this continent. I don't think that's being constructive. That is not being constructive. And again, these young people would not be out there in the streets if the civil rights movement had been a human rights movement. If the black community, instead of wanting to be integrated into a racist system, worked on black maintaining their black autonomy and just demanding the what was theirs, because they paid taxes, and demanding the return of those resources to their communities. She wrote a very long piece. Obviously, I don't have time to go over it because Tando Radio Show is coming up here at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. But I'm just very disgusted with this woman. Very disgusted with you, Grandma Barbara Reynolds. An ordained minister and author of 6 books, including the first unauthorized biography of Reverend Jesse Jackson. She is a former editor and columnist for USA Today. She was fired and perp walked out the building from what I read today, because she got emotional and didn't handle her firing too good. These are the people that Malcolm X talked about, man. But I'm not going to engage in derogatory language or anything like that towards these people. But I'm saying that this is an example of proxy racism. Her attacking those young people. She ain't offering nothing to constructive. Nothing constructive. Although, like every last single one of those protesters out there who may not even be an organizer or an activist, but they was like, you know what, I'm tired too, so I'm going to go just participate in this march. Every last single one of those people was wearing sagging pants, and you can see their underwear, Miss Reynolds. You're telling a damn lie, and you need to stop it. It's unchristian-like. You know, to tell lies. Ain't that a commandment? Thou shalt not lie or bear false witness. Because that is indeed what you are engaged in. bearing false witness against these young people. Do they have areas to improve upon? Certainly. I have areas to improve upon. And I certainly would say she has a big area to improve upon. And that area is getting rid of her anti-blackness towards these young people. The other thing I wanted to touch upon, I actually wrote an article about this, but I only focused on one of the things that Ben Carson pointed out or brought up in his article. He's attacking Black Lives Matter, saying that they, you know, a misfire. I don't know if I want to call it an attack, more so as a deflection. All right. He says that it's titled Ben Carson, Black Lives Matter Misfire. Who's he writing for? USA Today. With H-Rap Brown just saying that clip. White People's Press. Anything that you do not control is a weapon against you. All right. Just simply because they're giving black people access to their website does not mean that these websites are not racist and practicing racism. All right. So this is what he had to say. This ideal that disrupting and protesting Bernie Sanders' speeches will change what is wrong in America is lunacy. Nobody said that tactic in and of itself will change what's wrong in America. That's just one tactic. Like I, you know, intimated to the listening audience and to our guest, Ms. Wilson, that plenty of people have used that tactic throughout the years. Okay. Cold pink. LGBT activists, immigration reform activists, they have all interrupted these people. But I don't know so much if they were taking a task like, you know, people are piling on these Black Lives Matter people. He's saying the Black Lives Matter movement is focused on the wrong targets, to the detriment of blacks who would like to see real change, and to the benefit of its powerful white liberal funder. See, now that's a dog whistle for the white conservatives. This is and something I needed to correct myself on. I'm glad he brought that up, because now I have to issue a correction of something I stated. George Soros does not fund Black Lives Matter movement. George Soros gave $33 million to organizations that were long in existence before the Ferguson Rebellion kicked off. Before somebody created a hashtag called Black Lives Matter and then everybody else wanted to apply that name to the entire movement. All right. So those organizations just went to Ferguson and go to these other areas where there are uprisings and they provide support. You know, they provide instruction. They provide, you know, recommendations. They provide resources or whatnot. But that is not George Soros gave $3 million or $33 million, as I read the Washington Post, that Miss Reynolds was just dogging black people out in. They had wrote an article saying George Soros funded the rioting and the burning down the buildings. That's how the white media, the conservative racist media, was trying to portray it. That's incorrect. And this is what Ben Carson is alluding to here. This is what he's suggesting, that movement is controlled by a powerful white liberal. And that's not true. Do some of these organizations have ties to white liberal groups? And certainly they do. Should they be turning away resources from these white organizations or benefactors or whatever? Well, it depends. Does the money come with strings attached? Because if you're going to try to use your money to control my message or control my activity, then no, you can keep your money in your damn pocket. I don't want it. But if you believe in what we're already doing and you believe in the mission of what we're doing and you want to donate some money, most certainly we will accept that and we will put it to good use. But this notion that they are being controlled, that's yet to be proven, in my opinion. Simply accepting money from white people is not evidence that white people are controlling the movement. White people give money to Black Talk Media Project over the years we have been in existence as a nonprofit. Do you think white people control my message or control my mouth and the things I say on my radio program or any of the, you know, media partners? Most certainly not. They do not. But he goes on to distract from police brutality and shift the blame from the police and shift it on to the people. All right. He said that here's some of the bullet points that he made. Let me see here. Let me just read this. The notion that some lives might matter less than others is meant to enrage. That anger is distracting us from what matters most. We're right to be angry, but we have to stay smart. Yes, we do have to be smart. We can't be operating on emotion. Yeah, we have emotions. We'll get angry, but you're not supposed to act out of anger. You have to stay smart. I agree. Of course, the protesters are right that racial policing issues exist. And some rotten policemen took actions that killed innocent people. Those actions were inexcusable and they should be prosecuted to deter such acts in the future. But unjust treatment from police did not fill our inner cities with people who face growing hopelessness. Young men and women can't find jobs. Parents don't have the skills to compete in a modern job market. Far too many families are torn and tattered by self-inflicted wounds. Violence often walks alongside people who have given up hope. See, he's victim blaming here. He's victim blaming. The system did create urban ghettos. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about that. Young men and women can't find jobs because the so-called job creators, the 1% that, you know, your fellow Republican Mitt Romney said, you know, would, you know, don't tax them and they'll create jobs. Where the jobs at? Where the jobs at? Their loopholes are still in effect. President Obama's administration renewed the tax credits that, you know, Bush put in place for the wealthy. He extended those. He compromised with the Republicans. But where are the damn jobs? How is it that I can't find a job out here on the street, but when I go to prison, you can find me a job working for AT&T. You can find me a job working for Unicor. You can find me a job working for Wendy's or a subcontractor of Wendy's. You can find me a job, you know, working for a number of corporations. Parents don't have skills to compete in a modern job market. That's not unique to the black community. And job market research has shown that the United States is trending towards service-oriented jobs. Manufacturing left this country a long time ago and went overseas. And those jobs that went overseas are now coming back, but they're going into the prisons to utilize that prison slave labor. So he's victim blaming here. He went on to say, I grew up in neighborhoods most Americans were told to never drive through. I saw bullets, drugs, and death in the same places I played tag and ball with my friends. Both my older cousins died on the streets where I live. I thought that was my destiny. Look, I came up for my formative years on those same streets in Detroit, Mr. Carson. I wonder if I ever came across you in those streets. I was sucked into the gang banging and all of that and the drugs and all of that. But I was able to escape it. How was I able to escape it? By my mother literally leaving that trap and coming back down south. That's how I escaped it. But I also got cousins who stayed in Detroit who would be considered successful in terms of, you know, they got careers, they got education and all this and that. Don't make it seem like damn Detroit was like the Wild Wild West when you was coming up. Wasn't no more violent than any other place. But my mother didn't. She changed all of that. She saved my brother and me from being killed on those streets with nothing but a library card. Now, do y'all believe that? That I was about to say a cuss word. Because this guy is engaging for a neurosurgeon. You know, somebody we would consider a smart, educated person to say that he was saved by a library card, saved him from the street. That's just ignorance. That's just simplistic ignorance. Well, what do you say today when in Charlotte, North Carolina, they've been closing libraries, all right? What about the funding, you know, for these social programs, you know? So what's the good as a library card if you ain't got a library to go to in your community, Mr. Carson? Then he was like, you know, let's go over to the crack house. We need to tear it down. Profiting from selling poison to our children and destroying lives must not be the ambition of our children. These monuments to our destruction deserve our active scorn and not our silent acceptance. You mean like those, the silent acceptance that you have, Mr. Carson, of these white supremacists, racist enslavers, okay? I don't see you talking about that flag must come down. I don't see you saying remove these monuments to these Confederate generals who played such a big role in our destruction. I see you silently accepting that, and it deserves your active scorn. How dare black people be forced to maintain these symbols of racism and white supremacy? It makes absolutely no sense. It's an attack on the dignity of those black taxpayers to be forced to fund these monuments to white supremacy. But this ain't the 80s. This ain't the 90s. And I wrote an article specifically on this point yesterday, and I hope you'll check it out. The title of that article is Ben Carson Tells the Black Community to Get Rid of the Crack Houses to Address Police Terrorism. And I document in that article, I post videos, I link you to congressional hearings on the CIA crack cocaine conspiracy to smuggle, to create the crack houses in the black community, and not just going back to the 80s and 90s, but the recent revelation that the DEA had a deal with the Sinaloa drug cartel to allow them to smuggle drugs all the way up to Chicago unchecked in exchange for information from rival cartels. So I hope that y'all will check out that article. And on Thursday, we can go more into this. I know we do got a guest set up for Thursday, but we'll go more into that. But please check out my article. And it's a shame that these so-called people that would be considered black elders, educated people in our community are using racist dog whistles to attack the young people out there in the street fighting police brutality, a job that they did not finish themselves. And I ain't never heard of Ben Carson being active in anybody's movement. He only popped on the scene when he became a conservative and, you know, talking bad about black people. And, you know, that's the only qualification you need to be a black Republican. You could rise high in the Republican Party if you are willing to speak against black people publicly. So anyway, with that said, we have come to the end of the program. We're getting ready to transition into Tando Radio Show. He'll be talking about dealing with rampant crime when there's an economic collapse, the crime that you're going to have to deal with as people fight over resources and things of that nature. So that will be his topic of discussion. Listen, y'all, recognize the fact that you live behind enemy lines, that America is a battlefield, casualties are being created every day. If you don't believe me, go to killbypolice.net and you will see that it's thus far in 2015, over 700 people have been killed by police, many of them unarmed, many of them, I suspect, unjustified. Once you recognize that you live on a battlefield, then you could develop that battlefield awareness, develop those skills that will decrease the likelihood that you will become a victim. All right, because we don't want to see none of our black women being Sandra Blanded in Texas, no more than we want to see our black grandfathers choked to death on a New York sidewalk like Eric Gardner. All right, it's not your fault. They didn't deserve to get killed. You know, but it happens, and there are some things we could do to try to minimize that happening, but there are no guarantees. All right. So with that said, I will be back on air Wednesday night with New Abolitionist Radio at 8:00 p.m. Eastern time. Stay tuned for Tando Radio Show. Peace and blessings to all.